This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I hate to say it, but often when women show anger, it's not fully appreciated. It's often pushed onto emotional issues, perhaps, or deflected onto other people.
Former White House Russia expert Fiona Hill may have been angry, but she wasn't shrill. She had the accent and spoke from the diaphragm. Some of us don't, and that can make moments behind the mic a challenge. Not because of our voices, because of the mic and the frequency band. Women who appear in the public eye, or rather in the public ear, often are derided for the way they sound. But how they sound is also a product of how they're heard, and technology has a hand in that. In a recent article for The New Yorker, Clark University professor and musician Tina Tallon noted that, quote, women who speak publicly and challenge authority have long been dismissed as shrill or grating. We've often heard that women's voices are no good for the radio. Tallon says that's been the case since the invention of radio.
Right. So there was a great article published in the Radio Broadcast magazine in 1924, in which one of their editors actually interviewed a number of station managers. It was a female editor, by the way, pretty revolutionary for the time. And so she basically went through all of these various complaints that people had, and they ranged from everything regarding audio quality, saying that female voices or people with higher voices sounded distorted and nasal and tinny, to things about their personality and their senses of humor, saying that they're just not affable, they don't manage to really connect with listeners, or they sound inauthentic and affected. All of these criticisms have been established for nearly a century now and have associated with women in the media.
All the things that were said about Hillary Clinton when she was running.
We've heard the criticism before. That she sounds shrill, that she shouts, she doesn't smile enough.
Like a goosebumpy feel every time I hear Hillary's shrill voice rising and even higher and higher.
And Hillary, who's become very shrill, you know the word shrill? She's become shrill.
We see so much more of that now that we have more women running for president. Rather than talking about the content of their policy proposals, we're focused on the timbre of their voices.
And, of course, voices are among the most intimate ways that we encounter people. A person's voice is like a person's face.
The voice is the site of so much when it comes to identity construction, not just for the person speaking, but also for the listener. And there are so many patterns that we learn about who makes certain sets of sounds and how. And so some of it is based upon the way that we observe the world. And some of it is also culturally conditioned in the way that we're looking for who's allowed to speak in what contexts.
There was technology used for government purposes and all of that, but radio really began in this country in the mid-20s. That's where we need to peg the beginning of this tale.
Exactly. So in 1924, about 5% of households had radio receivers. By 1932, 60% of households had a receiver, and they were now in place in cars as well. And of course, the government needed to step in and start to regulate, because you ended up with frequent signal interference, especially in a lot of urban environments. And so finally, in 1927, the Federal Radio Commission went and decided to allot each station its own little 10,000 hertz slice of bandwidth real estate. So there's a segment before you take the signal and modulate it into something that can be transferred in between stations, known as the baseband or the pre-modulated signal. That had to be actually limited to 5,000 hertz because amplitude modulation actually doubles the bandwidth of the signal. So initially they said, okay, we're going to take all of our baseband signals and limit them to 5,000 hertz. What that meant was all of the microphones and all of the equipment that people were using to record didn't need to go above 5,000 hertz because none of that information would get transmitted.
Right. So what are we as human beings most attuned to? And then what were we able to hear on the radio?
Right. So there was some great research that happened in 1933 that basically looked at what are the frequencies that the human hearing apparatus is most sensitive to. And what they found is that we hear frequencies between about 1,000 hertz and 7,000 hertz more loudly than we hear frequencies at 100 hertz.
Mm-hmm. So in real life, we hear higher voices louder than lower voices. And on the radio, what happens?
What happened was there was a common thought at the time that women spoke more softly than men. A lot of this came from the result that the equipment that they were using to measure voices were optimized for lower voices by the people developing the technology, who were exclusively men in the early 1910s. And so they actually were missing a lot of the information at higher frequencies.
And so when you're not getting the same volume for women's voices, as you note in your article, you get less definition. The consonants are heard in the higher frequency ranges. And you can't compensate by pumping up the volume for women's voices because we already perceive them as louder. The evolutionary theory goes that higher pitched voices were voices of warning or something like that.
And so because the microphones were not as good at picking up these high frequencies, it was all or nothing, right? You either don't pick it up at all or you pick up the maximum amount and it's distorted and has that harsh edge on it. A lot of engineers thought, well, women are quieter. As soon as a woman would sit behind the microphone, many of them would automatically crank the dial up, which meant that you were going to get those distortions in whatever higher ranges that the microphone could pick up. And this led to a lot of issues with women being called unintelligible because we just couldn't figure out what the words they were saying were. All we could hear were the vowels.
There's an engineer you quote in your piece who tested his technology with women's voices and came to an interesting conclusion.
Yes, his name is R.C. Steinberg, and he was a researcher at Bell Labs. He was actually one of the more outspoken engineers who would present his research publicly. And so the first mention of this disparity was actually in the 1927 Bell Laboratories record. And he wrote a little brief, and it was entitled, Understanding Women.
Not their voices, just women.
Exactly, women. He quips that man's traditional inability to understand women may have a basis of fact if one so wishes to interpret certain recent experiments in our laboratories. And he talks about this disparity with consonants and the fact that people with higher voices tend to have consonants that lie between 5,000 and 7,000 hertz. The equipment at the time simply couldn't pick those up. And so there are actually these experiments where they figured out the quote-unquote intelligibility percentages at different cutoff levels. And they found that women were significantly harder to understand when everything above 5,000 hertz was cut off. But what's fascinating here is rather than advocating for changing the technology, he ends the article by saying, nature has so designed women's speech that it is almost always most effective when it is of soft and well-modulated tone. So here he's just saying, listen, ladies.
You're not built for the radio.
Exactly. Nature has just designed you this way. That's a bummer. Unfortunately, that stuck. There's no change in a lot of this technology. This government regulation in terms of the band limiting on these signals really, really influenced how manufacturers started making their equipment. And it stays that way. And so what that means is that if something isn't quite up to the quality that you're used to seeing, then we just throw away that material, right? This audio doesn't quite sound as good, and so therefore I'm just not going to include this. Unfortunately, we either completely exclude people or we include them in a way that diminishes mm-hmm. them. And so this lack of, not only lack of representation overall, but lack of accurate or lack of quality representation is a huge problem. We're leaving out the stories of entire demographics, ignoring the contributions of people simply because our technology is limiting their ability to exist in our mediums.
When I began work as an editor at NPR in the late 80s, I talked to a lot of women who were given kind of basic training before they went on the air, and this is NPR. They were told they sounded too young, they needed to lower their voices.
Right. The first time I've seen it discussed was 1906. There actually was a telephone switchboard operator's handbook where they talked about training the voice to become low and melodious and soft. And part of the reason, again, for that was because the microphones that were used to pick up sounds and telephone receivers were utter garbage.
Right.
In the early 1900s. They were terrible. And so all of this kind of started very, very early on.
You noted something across the ocean, the Maggie Thatcher effect.
Yes. So when she came to power, a lot of people dismissed Margaret Thatcher as a quote-unquote shrill housewife. And so between the 60s and the 80s, she actually worked with coaches to refine her vocal image. And she actually dropped her voice approximately 60 hertz. That's about half an octave in that range. And she was very transparent about this. Many scholars have written about this. Her biographer has written about this. And so the fact that she was able to become so successful, I think a lot of people started looking at that as an example.
Oh, very much so. I've done a good deal of other speaking, but speaking in the House of Commons is quite different.
I think we shall have to make up our minds about the cabinet very quickly, because otherwise the press will discuss it all for me.
Elizabeth Holmes, the founder of Theranos, which purported to have a great way to test people's blood. It turned out to be a lot of hooey. The saga turns very dark. But there was a lot of commentary about her voice.
And this was one of the most bizarre of the deceptions involved in this whole saga.
Her voice.
What she could figure out.
A surprising baritone.
Was that it would likely cost her a few thousand dollars to get these tests done.
In this interview with NPR from 2005, we hear a very different sounding Elizabeth.
No, it hasn't. Well, if I use traditional words to describe what we're doing, it's hard.
That was actually raw audio from an interview that she did back in 2005. She had kind of let her guard down, is the theory mm-hmm. here. And so you suddenly hear something that's a little bit more natural. Of course, she realizes it and dips back into this deep baritone. But if you go and analyze this recording, there's actually a disparity of about 100 hertz, which mm-hmm. is a huge amount. That's even more than Margaret Thatcher. Mm-hmm. That's something that surely doesn't just happen naturally.
Although her family did say she never changed her voice.
Exactly. And certainly there is a wide dynamic range that can occur as we get excited, you know, and we raise our voices to communicate enthusiasm or intensity. But what's very interesting, of course, is we're picking apart her voice, and that has no substance mm-hmm. when it comes to the actual facts of the court case. Sure, it kind of fits into this narrative of deception. And so I think it is an interesting thing to criticize. And everything about her image was criticized, from the black turtlenecks to the way she wore her hair. All of that became a part of this saga.
Yeah. Which brings us back to the candidates. The word shrill certainly was often applied to Hillary Clinton last time around. Here we hear Tucker Carlson doing precisely that in 2016.
A bunch of men, both running against her and also in the pundit class, who are saying things about her, that she's shrill, that she's shouting.
Maybe she is shrill. Maybe she is shouting. What does that have to do with her gender?
Because when was the last time you had a man be accused of being shrill? That is such a code word.
I don't know. I think a lot of men are shrill.
I don't think I've ever heard a man be called shrill.
First of all,
I called Ted Cruz shrill.
Can I just call BS this?
Yes.
No man on television has called Hillary Clinton shrill.
Oh, please.
Because that is a felony offense and everybody knows it.
I'm sure I can find another
example. No, nobody uses the word shrill.
I haven't actually heard that. I think one of the most hilarious parts of that clip is the fact that Tucker Carlson is yelling and the female host actually is maintaining a very level tone. And this is something we see time and time again. So many male candidates stand up there and literally yell. If a female candidate were to do the same thing, she would be viewed as hysterical, can't keep her temper in check. And so this is another aspect of this. There's a scholar who has coined the term animatedness about this, the idea that if you do nothing, you're viewed as doing something. And if you do something, it's viewed as a hyperbolic expression.
So what do you think? We're in a certainly a better spot than we were. There are a lot more women out there. I mean, have we finally gotten over the technological obstacles of the 1920s, or maybe the social cultural ones?
Well, I think we've certainly made a lot of progress, both on the technical and the cultural fronts. But one of the things that we deal with a lot now is compression algorithms. Now that we have digital technology, and streaming is actually one of the main modes of consumption now for any sort of audio or video. And what that means is that to reduce the amount of data and get it to your computer fast enough, or get it to your mobile device fast enough, it has to be compressed. We have to get rid of some of the information. And a lot of these algorithms disproportionately affect higher frequencies. Again, similar to the old microphones and the old transmission modes of the 1920s. For some reason, we haven't been able to transcend that, all based on a lot of the same not great research from the 1920s. So it still haunts us to this day. Now, culturally, I think we're definitely getting to a point where we're more critically examining the ways that we talk about women and people with higher voices and people with different identities in the media. And we're examining how that influences the way that their stories are told, if they're told at all. I've noticed a lot of people on Twitter ironically or sarcastically calling men shrill. But it still kind of feels like this very tongue-in-cheek type of application, because there's still this underlying knowledge of the long and gendered history of this insult.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this figures into this campaign?
I'm not sure yet. We keep running up against this word likability or electability. And I think that that has become the new shrill. Where there are gendered notions of who has what it takes to actually be in a position of authority, we're still not quite to the point where we're able to disentangle biases about gender from notions about who can lead and who is fit to lead.
Tina, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tina Tallon is a composer, musician, and professor at Clark University.
You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love, but confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Lowinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Astha Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show is edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.